So welcome everyone to this live conversation with His Holiness Radhanath Swami. Today we are very grateful, honored and privileged to have with us William Corgan. I mean, he needs no introduction at all. As soon as we put this poster out, thousands of messages came through flooding in saying him and his music was tremendous and revolutionary for so many people's childhood. But nevertheless, I want to say a few words just about him. He's an American musician, singer, songwriter, and also now a professional wrestling promoter. He is best known throughout the world as the lead singer, primary songwriter, and guitarist for the Smashing Pumpkins. Now, interestingly, William was born and raised in Chicago, which is also where His Holiness Radhanath Swami was born and spent his childhood. And since we have many new people joining in today, I also want to say a few words about His Holiness Radhanath Swami before we hand it over to William. So His Holiness Radhanath Swami is a teacher, New York Times bestselling author and activist. He's best known throughout the world for his philanthropic activities, which includes feeding 300,000 children every single day in downtown Mumbai, as well as opening up a hospital which provides healthcare and many life-saving treatments for those that otherwise would not have access to these treatments. And more recently, he has founded the Govardhan Eco Village, which has been awarded by the United Nations. It's a retreat center as well as a resort. At the same time, it also has a yoga school, Ayurvedic hospital, animal sanctuary, and it is known as a model for sustainable living throughout the whole world. So we're grateful to both of you for taking the time out for making this conversation happen. And without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to William to host and guide this conversation. Thank you so much.
All right. Hello, everyone. Hello, His Holiness. Nice to see you again.
Wonderful to be with you, William. I'm so grateful to be with you.
Thank you, my friend. A little quick story, and I'll let you kind of throw in on this. So His Holiness grew up in the town that I live in, which is Highland Park, Illinois, about 25 miles north of Chicago, Illinois, in America. And the way we met is quite auspicious, as I bought his book. And I was just interested in reading what he had to say. I had no understanding of his story. And, you know, on page 37, he literally is growing up in the book in the very city that I live in. So after I finished the book, I wrote him a note. And a little while later, he reached out to me. And that's how we became friends. And we got a chance to visit when I had I have a tea house here in Highland Park called Madame Zuzu's. And at our old location, His Holiness came and we had a nice afternoon sitting. And that's how we got to meet and stay in touch. And so that's sort of the subtext of our being together, but it doesn't necessarily dictate what we want to talk about today. So anything you want to add to that, that introduction there?
I'm just thrilled with beautiful memories of meeting you and your good wife and your stepmother and your children. It was a feast for my heart. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we were blessed by you that day. So, knowing I was going to host this and knowing that some of my friends, and we call them the SP fam, the fans of my band, the Smashing Pumpkins, were going to come and maybe not be familiar with your story. And I highly recommend His Holiness's books. They're not only spiritually illuminating, the stories are really fantastic, really warms the heart. And as you can hear from his activism, he's a man after my own heart, you know, take the world by the horns and go out and change the world. So can you, because we're different generations, but knowing the kind of world that you grew up in, can you tell people a little bit about your life growing up? And not so much, I don't want you to repeat your story, but of course, if you want to, but it's more of, I'm curious what your first inklings of spirituality were. Because in the world that I grew up, which I assume is very similar to the one you grew up in, you had Jews, you had Christians, that was the predominant, religious sects in Chicago at that in those years. Obviously, we have a lot more now. And so I'm curious, you know, growing up in this beautiful bucolic suburb, it's on a lake here in Chicago. What were your first inklings of spirituality, or was that something that came later? Post your childhood, so to speak.
Thank you, William. I'm just so happy to be with you. I'm speechless, but you're asking me to speak, so I'll try. You know, when I was 5 years old, my family moved here. In those days, the western side of the railway tracks were a place of struggling middle-class people trying to somehow make it. All the houses were the same. And, you know, it was a beautiful area with so many trees. And at that time, as I write in the Journey Home, there was my best friend. I think I was about 7 years old. And he told me that his father and mother hated me. And I asked why. And he said, because you're Jewish. And not only do my parents hate you, but they told me God hates you. And, you know, I was too young to really reason or try to philosophically adjust what I just heard. I was quite mortified. And I was in his house, and we went upstairs, and his parents were there, and they were looking at me. And I remember I came home, and I asked my mother, does God hate me?
Sorry to laugh, but it's a good one.
And my mother looked at me and said, God loves you. Why are you asking this question? But I was afraid to tell her why. So I just ran upstairs and ran into my little bedroom I shared with my brother. And I looked up at the ceiling, and I was just trying to understand, you know, who is this God? And why? And even in that time, I was thinking, why there's so much hate in the name of a loving God? And as I grew up, of course, you know, I learned to adjust to these things. And I saw a lot of hypocrisy in the name of religion, and a lot of arrogance and prejudice. And at that time, when I was a teenager, I became very much an activist in the civil rights movement of Dr. Martin Luther King. And just so many things didn't make sense. I gradually became a part of the counterculture. And in 1968, at the Democratic Convention in Grant Park of Chicago, I was just there to give a voice of my concerns, what was going on in the world and in our country. And I didn't mean anyone harm. And the Chicago police, they tear gassed me and were chasing after me with clubs. But in those days, I was a pretty fast runner, so I did get away. But it was turbulent times. And I remember I came to a crossroads where either I had to reject religion, I had to reject the idea of spirituality, because I saw bigotry, racism, anti-Semitism, hatred, and in the name of God. So is it really doing good for the world? But, you know, I prayed and I came to my own conclusion that there must be something at the very heart, in the essence of all these great spiritual paths, that's common and unifying and truly beautiful. Because every religion is talking about love, unconditional love. And I was looking for that common essence. And I more or less dedicated my life to finding that. And I started studying because I felt that if I could find it in my own religion, I could see it in all religions. But I had to have a certain confidence that it was there in all religions. So I started, you know, searching various religions. And,
yes.
And after some time, you know, being involved in the counterculture and the civil rights movement, I found that people like Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, he was an activist, but the foundation of his activism was something religious, something spiritual. And I was reading about Mahatma Gandhi And he was also a very devout person who followed a religion. He read Bhagavad Gita. And that if we can't change ourselves, if we can't be the change we want to see in the world, we can't really do that much for the world. And I was really looking to find that internal transformation.
Wow, that's very humbling to hear. I was thinking when you were talking, because, you know, like I said, we grew up in a similar environment. You know, I lived in such a cloistered world that I didn't even necessarily know what Jewish people were. My family didn't talk about Jewish people. If they did, they usually probably said something negative, but I didn't know what it meant. And I dated a woman when I was 17 years old. And she said to me, when we started to get close, you know, romantically, she said, "I'm a Jew. Is that a problem?" And I thought, I didn't even know what it meant. You know, I didn't understand the weight of the question. The fact that she even had to ask it shocked me now. But at the time I was completely innocent. I was raised Roman Catholic. And I thought, you know, I was told that was, there was one path and you did that or you're going to hell and all that stuff. And I remember, much like you, sitting in church about the age 8 years old and looking at Jesus on the cross and thinking, this is not adding up in my brain. And that's not to criticize anybody, but in my brain, it didn't add up that I was being told that, you know, on one hand, I was, you know, they were talking about love and universal love and God forgives and confess your sins and all this stuff. But if you don't, you're going to be punished into hellfire. And I, as a child, it just didn't resonate with me. So that initiated my own spiritual path to try to ask those same questions. Gosh, I don't even know where to go from there. I was just so humbled by your answer. Thank you. You know, in your first book, you go into great depth. And again, I highly recommend reading the book. It's a beautiful book to read. But just give a little synopsis on how a young Jewish boy makes his way from Highland Park, Illinois to India. You know, I know it's a much longer story, but can you kind of, because it's not necessarily where I want to dwell, because I'm sort of much more interested in your spiritual journey, but I still find it fascinating that you left this place to go all the way over there.
Well, you know, it was at that time when I was just questioning everything, because I was seeing so many contradictions. I was seeing, you know, people who were struggling. When I was about 10 years old, my father went in total bankruptcy. He sold a car called the Edsels, and they didn't do very well. And so I was always getting jobs, and most of the people I worked with were African-American people, and they were my parents' age, but they were my best friends. We, you know, we loved each other, but I just saw how downtrodden they were, and there were just so many contradictions of people who had so much, but their values were so little. And I didn't know where I fit in. And after some time, I didn't even know how I fit in the counterculture, because I saw many of the same elements as the counterculture that we were revolting against were among each other. So I really decided that it's in spirituality that we could really find the love that we're looking for. And until we become an instrument of that love, we're not really full in our life. So one day, my best friend, Gary, he called me and said he was going on a trip to Europe. I was 19 at the time. It was the summer of 1970. And I said, "I have no money." And he said, "I don't either, but our friend Frank is going to pay for both of us." So we ended up going to Europe. In fact, I was on the plane. Johnny Winter, a great musician, was sitting next to me.
That's fantastic.
On the plane from Chicago to New York. I write about that in the book. It was quite interesting. And then we flew to Iceland and then Luxembourg. And then the day we got there, Frank got robbed. And he had nothing. So Gary and I stayed, and we just learned to survive, and we were hitchhiking. And I was in many ways going, you know, to make the scene, you know, with the counterculture in Amsterdam and in London. And we went to the Isle of Wight Rock Festival and all these places. But more and more, I was gravitating toward going to parks and forests and museums and cathedrals and churches and synagogues, trying to find my soul. And I was reading spiritual books. And I remember in Italy, I became very close with one Franciscan monk. And I remember crying and telling him, revealing my heart, you know, I love Jesus, but I'm Jewish. Am I betraying my faith? And there's so much antagonism between the two faiths. Where do I fit in if I'm Jewish, but I love Jesus? And he held my hand and said that we're all looking for the same love, God's love. And, you know, it's only, you know, small-mindedness that causes all these conflicts. So that gave me a rest assurance. And eventually, it's a long story, as you know, you read the book, but from the island of Crete in Greece, I was living in a cave with Gary, and I was praying and praying and praying throughout the day, sitting on the top of a mountain all alone for direction. And I was praying to God for direction. And right at the sunset one day, I heard this voice in my heart. It was a silent voice, but it was louder than anything I ever heard. And it spoke three words: go to India. And I had never met an Indian person in my life. I never ate a chili pepper up till then in my life. I didn't know where India was. I didn't have any money to buy a map. But I went back to the cave and I told Gary, at sunrise tomorrow, I'm going to start hitchhiking to India. And of course, he didn't want to come with me. So then I went through the Middle East, through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And as I was studying Judaism and Christianity very quite intensely in Europe, I was studying Islam in the Middle East. And eventually I arrived in India. It took about almost 6 months to get to India of hitchhiking. And there were many educational experiences on the way and life-changing experiences. And when I arrived in India, I had gotten so many diseases, and it was really difficult just being without money traveling to the Middle East. And the Indian immigration would not allow me in because I only had 26 cents. And she said that I needed at least $200. They have enough beggars in India. So I was crying and pleading, and she totally rejected me. And for about 6 hours, I was in this no man's land between Pakistan and India, and they were not friendly with each other. And I had nowhere to go. There were no phones in the no man's land. And I couldn't go back to Pakistan because I didn't have a visa to get back. So I was just trapped there. And eventually the guard changed just around sunset. And this man who was from the Sikh culture, he told me that I was rejected unless I could show him $200. And I cried and I begged him, and, you know, please give me a chance. I've risked my life. I've come all the way across the world because I want to learn from your people. I want to learn from your culture. Please give me a chance. And I remember he looked at me and really like investigated my mind through his stare for about a minute and said, sometimes a man must follow his heart. He said, I've been ordered by my commanding officer to reject you, but I'm going to give you the chance that you're crying for. And then he stamped my passport and said, he put his hand on my head because I was 19. He was in his 50s. He said, "I bless you that you will find what you're looking for." Wow. He said, "Welcome to India."
So beautiful. I know the story, but it touches me all over again. This is God works in such mysterious ways. And there it is right there. In preparing to talk to you today, because I, like I said, I know some of the people watching wouldn't necessarily be familiar with Indian spiritual culture. It's kind of a two-part question. Please take it however you want. One is, obviously, Indian spiritual culture is very complex. There's lots of sects and the Jains, and I mean, it's super complicated, and it's beautiful in its complication. There's no criticism in that. I was stunned when I went there and I witnessed it, you know, seeing the wandering sadhus and, you know, the guys painted orange and just this, you know. I know what I'm talking about. And I don't know what I'm talking about. I was in India once, and I remember just looking around saying, what an incredible, vast, rich culture this is, especially for someone who's interested in spirituality. So I'm curious for your first impressions when you actually went into the country and saw that. And then secondarily, this is a little bit more complicated. As you know, having grown up in the West, you know, the idea of sublimating one's ego to a guru, to giving yourself over to your guru. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's my general understanding of the process. I'd be curious if you could talk about that, because I think that's partly what confuses people about that sort of religious, that asceticism or that sort of approach from religion. Because obviously most people grow up here, here's your God, here's your manual, here's your date to show up at church. You know, we just had Yom Kippur, you know, here's what you do. There's obviously much different system in terms of spiritual pursuit. So if you could kind of address that too, if that's okay.
You are truly leading me toward the essence. Thank you, William.
Awesome.
Yes, when I first arrived in India, I had already, you know, for me, I went quite deeply into Judaism and Christianity. I lived, you know, with monks and monasteries in Italy and various parts of Europe. And then I learned from wonderful scholars of Islam when I was hitchhiking through the Middle East. And I saw that in every religion, there's the beautiful people who really have connected with humility and gratitude and respect for life and a universal idea of love. And I saw that in true followers. And I also saw in every religion, there was, you know, those who were kind of leaning on their religion as a crutch for their insecurities or their need to feel themselves better than others. And that's just human nature.
Yeah.
When I arrived in India, you know, after the Middle East in those days, it was quite colorful. And I had already read some books, you know, and I was already doing some meditations in my prayers. And I went to the Himalayas. And the first day I was there, I was just sitting on the bank of the Ganges River, all alone in a very lonely place. And this one holy man came out of the jungle and he said to me that, "You don't know who I am, but I know you."
Wow. Beautiful.
And then he said, "Take off your Western clothes and offer them to the Ganges, and I will give you the robes of a sadhu." I never heard the word before. I said, "What's a sadhu?" And I was pretty apprehensive about giving up my clothes because I only had one set of clothes. Because, you know, my whatever else I had was stolen, you know.
Wow.
Travels. I just had what I was wearing. And I was amazed how much I was really attached to them. when it came to the point of throwing him in a river. And I said, what's a sadhu? And he said, it's a homeless person who's wandering, searching for God and enlightenment. And I thought, God, that's just what I'm doing.
I'm there. I'm already there.
So I took off my clothes and put them in the Ganges, and he gave me two strips of cloth to wrap around my upper and lower part of body. And then I was just wandering, meeting different holy people in the Himalayas. And I was studying with Buddhist masters, Dalai Lama, and Tibetan Buddhism, and Zen Buddhism, and Burmese Buddhism. And I was meeting so many different sects of Hinduism. And, you know, I also studied Baha'i. So there were just so many different things, and they're all in India. India has one of the oldest Christian communities. St. Thomas, who was one of the original apostles of Jesus, went to India and established Christianity there, and it's been ever since. Has one of the oldest Jewish communities. It's the place where Buddhism began, Sikhism began, Jainism, Hinduism, and all of its different varieties. And, you know, today it's the second most populated nation of people of the Islamic faith. So India is really quite a place of mixture of religion. And as you said, you know, that diversity, we can really appreciate the beauty of the diversity when we understand what unifies all these different spiritual paths. That, you know, that there's one God, and this is the Hindu conception too of the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedas, that there is one God, but that one God expands in many ways, at many times, to come to this earth to give the same message. There's a beautiful verse in Gita, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam dharmasya tadatmanam shajamyaham. Or Krishna speaking, that there's one supreme God, and that one supreme Lord appears in different forms with different names throughout history to give the same message to different people in different cultures. And I could see that really this idea of dharma includes all religion, because all religion are teaching essentially the same values and the same goal to reconnect with that love, with God's love within our heart, and to rise above selfishness and egoism and all the sufferings and miseries that come with that. That, you know, in the Bible, Jesus said, what profiteth a person if they gain the whole world, if they lose their soul? And, you know, we are that soul, we are that living force that's animating this temporary body, and the soul is beyond birth and death. And when we connect to our soul, we realize we're a part of God, and our true nature is to experience God's infinite, sweet, most beautiful love, and to be an instrument of that love. And when we realize that myself within, as a part of the perfect God, I am beautiful, my soul. And when we recognize that, we could perceive that inherently, wherever there's life, there's a beautiful part of God. Life is sacred, and creation is sacred when we see it in relationship to God's energy. And this is really at the heart of all the different sects and all the different colors that people paint themselves, as you're explaining. That's really at the heart of it. And, you know, there's different ways that people are trying to reach that essence, that love. And the more we can find the truth within our own practice, the more we could recognize and not only tolerate, but really appreciate and love the beauty within another spiritual path. And to the degree we have that experience in our life, and that's what all true religions are bringing us to, that experience, then we see the unity within this incredible diversity, and it becomes very meaningful and very beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I still want to get to the guru question, but to interject for a second, I think that's something that is so important to hear right now, because obviously, you know, you know what's going on here in the West, here in America, I don't even know how to quantify it, you know, we're past discussion somehow, we're into this other thing. And you think what will bring people back to the table to listen to one another? At the core of what's happening outside of the politics, certainly on the civil rights side, the core message is absolutely critical, which is that every life matters. In this case, obviously, the message is Black Lives Matter, and I couldn't agree with that more. But this, you know, this reminder that we need to cherish life is sacred, that we cannot look, you know, we cannot turn a blind eye to the injustices in the world. And so I'm cheered by that. What's unfortunately, you know, but as you know, because you went through it in the late 60s, when it starts to spill into other things, particularly violence and stuff, that's where it becomes sort of not just frightening, but so sad, because it's the message is in there and it gets obscured. Anyway, I don't necessarily want to stumble around in that, but it's important, I think, to point out the message that you're talking, which is unity. You know, unity is God's love as a unifying force is the one thing that can be counted on, no matter what the generation is, no matter what the politics are, no matter the country. And so I'm heartened to hear you say that. And it's not that I don't know it, I just need to hear it myself, you know.
There's a beautiful verse from the Bhagavad Gita. And when I first heard this verse, I remember thinking, that's it. This is what I'm looking for.
Ah, beautiful.
And that verse is Vidyavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gavihastini Suni Chaiva Swapakeja Panditasama Darshana. The definition of wisdom, the definition of enlightenment, the definition of knowledge, according to the Gita, is to see all living beings with equal vision. Whether one is white or black or red or brown or yellow, whether one is male or female, whether one is a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Jain or a Sikh or a Baha'i or a Buddhist or a Hindu, whether one is from the East or the West, whatever nationality, whether one is from a wealthy social status or a simple social status, to see the equality of all beings. And the Gita even extends whether one's a human or a dog or a cat or an elephant or a cow, wherever there's life, there is the pursuit of happiness. You know, the bird in the tree, I was just looking at a bird today in a tree, and he's just looking for happiness, or she, I can't really distinguish, but that bird was looking for happiness, you know, looking for food, looking for protection, and everyone's looking for happiness. And it's the nature of the soul, ananda mayo byasha, to seek pleasure. And because originally, the nature of the soul is ananda. It's full of pleasure. And that pleasure is tasting the sweetness of God's love, because things could give some amount of pleasure to the mind and to the physical senses, but things cannot give satisfaction to the heart. Only to love and be loved gives satisfaction to the heart. And the origin of that is God's love, and sharing that God's love with all beings and to our capacity.
Yeah.
And that's actually what is at the heart of all true spiritual paths. And that's just so much needed. And we see when we disconnect from ourself, Emerson said, there's so many chaotic situations in this world because human beings are disconnected from their own selves. And that journey within, that connection to ourself, actually equips us with a foundation where we can express our love through compassion. The most universal principle of Dharma is the value and the character of a compassionate lifestyle. That's something all spirituality has in common, to seek to live in a spirit of compassion, to in the Vedic literatures, there's a beautiful statement, sarve sukhano bhavantu, that the whole purpose of Dharma or religion is to be in a mood where our prayer is, may all beings be happy. And what you asked about Guru, and that's what Guru is. He or she is a person who's trying to reconnect us. And, you know, there's different conceptions of Guru. But the Guru is not God. The Guru is a humble servant of God who's connected to God. And in our tradition, we believe that, you know, gurus come through a lineage or parampara, a lineage of great saints who have preserved that very essential message. Because as we know, there are so many ways we can interpret a scripture, and every scripture is subjected to people's interpretations. And when we interpret with the lens of our own insecurities or egoism, you know, then the absolute power of God could bring absolute horror. You know,
well, that's kind of, sorry to interrupt you, but that was kind of, that's sort of at the heart of my question, because I think this is something that's always fascinated me. So whether you want to talk about it personally or not, it's the conception of placing yourself before a guru and sublimating your ego to this person that you recognize is on some level has a connected, you know, a telephone line to God. I know that's a terrible way to put it, Sarah. I don't mean to offend anybody. All I'm saying is, obviously, the devotee recognizes something in the guru that says, follow this person. This person will lead you the right way. But invariably, most of the stuff I've ever read about people who put themselves through the process, it's the breaking down of the ego structure, particularly for a Western mind, to place themselves into that construct. Can you talk about that at all? Because I just find it so fascinating.
It's a very deep subject. In general principle, the guru is a teacher who, through knowledge that is being preserved through a lineage of great teachers, is presenting knowledge and who exemplifies that knowledge by his or her lifestyle. And in that way gives us light to illuminate us from the darkness. And the guru is teaching us how to be a truly humble servant of the Supreme, who has many names, and how to live in harmony with the Supreme. The word acharya, which is means one who teaches by example. And I remember when I first met my own guru, his name is Srila Prabhupada. Actually, it was the second time I met him. I was living in Vrindavan, which is the place where Krishna lived 5,000 years ago. And it's for devotees on the path of bhakti or devotion, it's the holiest of holy places in the world. And in those days, it was a very simple village on the banks of the Yamuna River. And I was there for about 6 months, and Prabhupada came. And he was sitting in a little room, and there was just about five or six people there. And one person asked Prabhupada a question. I think the person was a journalist. He said, "Are you the guru for the whole world?" And Prabhupada lived in Vrindavan, you know, in his earlier days. He was a saint in Vrindavan, and he left Vrindavan and came to New York City, and then he traveled around the world many times. So this was 1971 when this story was. So he had brought people who were following him from all over the world with him, and he had established temples, and he had composed literatures and translated literatures that were selling in the tens of millions even at that time. And he was asked, "Are you the guru for the whole world?" And I remember Prabhupada, I was just sitting on the floor with everyone else, cross-legged, and he looked down at the floor, and he looked very humble. And then he looked up at us and said, "No, I am just the servant of everyone. That's all."
Wow.
And when he said that from such a deep place in his heart, I thought, that's what the guru of the world should think like. And there could be many gurus. There could be many gurus, but yeah, this is actually the quality of a true guru, is to want to be the servant of everyone. And we serve, you know, physically, you know, by providing physical stuff, emotionally, by kindness. But the guru's special role is to serve the soul, to serve, because, you know, we may be eating so nicely and have so much fame, you know, to nourish our minds, but our hearts are starving without God's love. And to nourish and to feed and to teach people how to connect to that love, and then how to express that intent to love God, you know, in whatever we do, whether we're monks or swamis, or whether we're doctors or lawyers or entertainers or musicians or in business or in technology, or whether we're farmers or we're professors, mothers, fathers, whatever our role in society is, that's the perfect religious path if we connect to that deep devotion and compassion that's inherent within us. And we try to express that compassion through our particular roles in society. Mm-hmm. And that's what he was teaching. And if the guru wants to be the servant of everyone, then what to speak of the student? Just wants to learn how to be the servant of everyone. And that's how I actually really connected to my guru, just wanting to emulate that.
Yeah. No, thank you. Sorry, just taking that in for a second.
I hope that answers the question to some extent.
Yeah, I think I'm probably selfishly curious about, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's the same for all religious pursuit, which is your own ego, you know, with a capital E, comes in contact with a greater force. And the only way to move forward spiritually is you have to let go of something that you thought was so important. You know, I've had a crash course in that, in being in public life for 30 years. Sorry, I lost you for a second. Yeah, I just got lost in my own ego there for a second. Sorry. So last question, because my iPad's going to die. I don't know why it's draining down so fast. My last question is you've been in spiritual practice for 50 years plus. And having sat with you, you know, and certainly done a lot of work myself, there's, let's call it, and I'm using my own language here, there's like the other side of the veil, and there's this world. And, you know, anybody of course has the ability to move between the temporal world and the world of the cosmos. Having spent so much time in spiritual practice and in devotion, and having, I would understand, a greater sense of timelessness and human endeavor, and obviously you're very in it. You know, you're not just sitting on a mountain meditating. I mean, you're in it every day. You're helping feed people. You're educating. You're healing. What would be like a way you could say, what can you bring back after 50 years that you can say to somebody? I know you said it, but maybe I'm being redundant. But what can you say to somebody who's very much in the temporal life, the daily struggle of life? Like, what have you learned in 50 years of being on the other side of that? Does it make sense? I know it's a terrible question the way I'm framing it, but I know, I think I know you understand.
You are eloquent, William. You are really eloquent.
God bless you, my friend.
You present things in such an honest, heartfelt way, and it's really beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
If my answers could be as sweet as your questions, I will be very happy. There's four principles that I found are very universal and very sacred, and also completely practical, because time is something that's very precious. Every moment we can invest in something that's wasted, or we can invest in something that's forever. So our time needs to be balanced, and our life needs to be balanced. And that balance means harmonizing different aspects of who we are. So satsang is a Sanskrit word.
Sorry, just ignore me. I'm going to plug in my iPad. I don't want to lose you.
No, please.
No, please. Please don't let me stop you.
We're having a tour of your home.
Just my ceiling. Okay, I'm safe now. Sorry about that. Speaking of time management. I'm here.
Oh, it's a beautiful library you have. Satsang.
Oh, thank you.
Satsang means to balance our time in a way that we make a priority whenever possible to be with people that enlighten us, with very positive people, with spiritually enlightened people, with people who are seeking spiritual enlightenment. That association, that satsang, is very, very important. Many times I've been invited to 12-step meetings. I've never myself been addicted, but I've been invited as a guest speaker, especially in India. And I see how much just the company of like-minded people who have a common need that they're trying to help each other with, how much strength that gives people. And on a spiritual path, because there is so much egoism and greed and selfishness and envy and anxiety and depression, there's so many of those things in this world, and hatred and violence. You know, we become nourished and strengthened, and the compass of, or the North Star of our aspirations in life, is clear to us when we're with people who are giving us this positive energy and sharing spiritual truths together. And that's a very important thing, satsang, to be with holy people or people who are aspiring to live a pure life. Mm. And the second is sadhana. When we have that faith and direction, then we need to excavate within ourselves to put some priority time aside every day for our spiritual practice. It may be meditation, it may be prayer, it may be puja or worship. In my tradition, you know, we read from holy books and we also chant mantras and we sing God's names and Hare Krishna. And these are, this sadhana is putting some quality time aside a day to actually connect with the frequency of our souls, to connect with the frequency of God's love that is within us, but somehow we're so distracted from it, to give some time to actually make that connection. Mm. And however busy we are, you know, we have somehow we find time to eat and we have find time to sleep. We should find time to nourish our souls too, because our souls are hungry for that connection. So satsang, good company, sadhana, having a dedicated spiritual practice, and then sadachar. And with the foundation of inner moral value strength that we have within from these two, we try to live with character. We try to live with values. I remember Martin Luther King said that his dream that we will not judge a person by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And this is so important, that we live with character. We live in and from that sadachar or character, we value seva, how we can be a well-wisher to others, how we could uplift others, how we could, we find the joy in serving others. The idea in giving we receive is such a deep universal truth. It is so true. The more we give of God's love, the more we receive it. The more we give of goodness, the more we become good. And the more we have, the more we could give. And the more we give, the more we get. And that's the principle of spirituality. And in my 50 years, I've seen CEOs of international corporations, and I've seen people in the political world, and I've seen people who are simple monks in a monastery who all live by that same principle. Hmm. From our eco village, we go out to villages, you know, hundreds of villages where these people are living in a lot of poverty. And whether the person's living in a little hut in a village or in a mansion in the city, I see that everybody has the opportunity to live in this light of love if we just apply these four principles. Mm. To be with enlightening company, to tune in every day through a spiritual practice, to try to strive to live with character and values, and to cultivate an awareness of the beauty of serving. You know, in a family, when a child is very young, the child really gives nothing to the parent except the opportunity for the parent to serve. And
that's the truth.
There is nothing so fulfilling to the parent's heart than just serving the child. And the more we understand that everyone's God's child, we feel that in the way we live. It's like an expansion of that same principle we're finding at our own home.
I'm with you on the serving the child with my two little ones. All right, my friend. Thank you. I'm afraid this is going to die. So no parable there, but thank you. It's so good to see you. I hope to see you soon.
Well, William, it's really a joy to see you, and thank you for being who you are, and thank you for your aspirations, you know, through whatever you do. I know you're really trying to be everyone's well-wisher and trying to give whatever enlightenment you can, and I'm just so grateful to see that.
Thank you, my friend. Yeah, I think the thing that marks the last few years of my life is a deep gratitude. It's a really deep gratitude to understand not only the gifts I was given, but the gifts I can share. And I truly endeavor every day to share those gifts in a way that will lift people up and inspire. And so talking to you today is part of that. And so God bless you. Great to see you. I talk to you soon.
Thank you. Gratitude is really like the mother of all other virtues. And I'm so grateful to you. And I'm so grateful for everyone who's with William and myself today for this wonderful conversation.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, everyone. Bye, my friend.